All right. Well, hi. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. If you want to start by just introducing yourself, who you are, where you're from, and what you're doing here this weekend at the Vets for Peace Conference.
Sure. My name is Brittany Ramos-Taveros. I live in New York City. I am a member of About Face, Veterans Against the War, which are all post 9/11 military veterans organizing against U.S. militarism and the ongoing wars that many of us served in. I am here at VFP because I was invited to share a little bit about my story of resistance. So that's a huge honor. I'm really excited about that. And I am just really, I think we can just stop there.
Yeah, sure. So, are you still active?
That was the other thing I was going to say, which is that strangely, today is my very last day as a captain in the reserves, in the Army Reserves, and I finally have orders that are effective today to go into the IRR, and I'll be submitting my resignation to get completely out soon.
Wow, congratulations.
Thanks. Yeah, definitely a long time coming.
Yeah, so I guess when you talk about your resistance and your move, I guess I'm just curious about your Army story from like when you enlisted to when you got some notoriety for going off on Twitter and everything in between.
Yeah, thanks. I grew up in Texas. I grew up in a really patriotic family. My mom's an Army officer. But also I'm biracial, and I grew up, I think, with a keen sense, even very young, that there were kind of two different Americas that people were living in, I think, watching the differences between the ways that the different sides of my family were able to exist in the world. And so I very early on had a passion for justice. You know, adults were always saying, Brittany, you just need to accept that the world isn't fair. And I was like, it's not fair because you just let it not be fair. You know, that was always a thing. And then in high school, I got into debate. And that was when I started really, my politics started changing. You know, I had grown up in this very, like, I don't know what people would probably think of as a stereotypical, like, conservative Texan mentality. And I also very religious, you know. And in debate, I started getting exposed to all of this literature, and I even ended up reading, like, international relations theory that exposed me to words like militarism and military-industrial complex. But when it came time, when it came time for me to figure out what I wanted to do, I knew that I wanted to be able to work towards justice. I knew that that was something that I wanted to be a part of. But I still had a limited kind of understanding of how change happens. So from my perspective, it was like I watch national politicians on the news trying to make change, talking about justice, and that's how you make justice. But then I thought, well, how do I, as a nobody Latina, like, get to the position that you can, you know, be powerful enough to change the system, not just be addressing the symptoms? And it seemed clear to me that all the, you know, talking heads on the news, where every time something came up about whether the wars were just or women in combat or don't ask, don't tell, which were all topics that were prominent in the news at that time, someone would be like, well, you don't know what you're talking about because you've never served. And I was like, okay, as a woman, people are going to question my, like, my strength, my ability to make the tough choices and decisions to lead. And it seems like I need that on my resume. And then, you know, of course, I was looking for resources to be able to be financially independent, to go to school and things like that. So I applied for the ROTC scholarship under this kind of vision that I would be the kind of leader that if only terrible leaders, right, who had a particular, like, what I would see as regressive worldview joined, then if the military is inevitable, it'll never change, right? So I was like, different types of leaders need to join and make it better from within. That was kind of my analysis at the time. And then, you know, also resources and my hopes for the future about politics and things like that. So I got the ROTC scholarship, went through ROTC, commissioned into as a logistics officer, went to officer basic, and then deployed to Afghanistan almost immediately.
And what year was that you deployed to Afghanistan?
I deployed in 2012.
Okay.
Yep, and I came back in 2013. And it was bizarre even then, because this was under Obama. And already, when I told people that I was deploying to Afghanistan, people constantly were just like, we're in Afghanistan still? Like, I thought we left Afghanistan. And I was like, no, we're still having a war there, you know? And I remember just being really struck by even how invisible it was then. And then I deployed, and at the time I was a true believer. I was like, you know, the Taliban is this abusive organization. We're there trying to, like, help the Afghan people be self-sufficient, be able to protect themselves. This kind of whole narrative of, like, liberating the Afghan women, right, mm-hmm. that Laura Bush had spun when I was in high school. Mm-hmm. So when I got there, though, I ended up getting put into a role where I was spending a lot of time engaging with Afghan civilians. Mm-hmm. And it became clear to me really quickly that how frequently we were not the good guys, right? And, like, the kind of stepping stone for me was seeing this mission on paper that we were given, right, to train up the Afghan army, to, like, support them, to protect the civilian population, all of these things, and then watching individual commanders day after day having to fight with them because they just wanted the opportunity to do aggressive, exciting-sounding things, you know. Conversations like, well, this village isn't cooperating, so we're going to do a night raid. And I was like, that is not our mission. You know, that is not our mission. And coming in as a bright-eyed person who believed in the mission, I was horrified by that, you know, by all of these kind of hyper-masculine, especially commanders, who just wanted to enact their fantasies. Mm-hmm. But, seeing it so often, that was when I started to see the system for what it was. I was like, even if this is the right mission at this point in my thinking, mm-hmm. this is a killing machine, right? This is a machine that has been built to do violence and that is not able to make the change, no matter how many, you know, kind of ridiculous, very surface-level cultural awareness trainings mm-hmm. they send these guys to. Like, sure. They still joined to do violence. Mm-hmm. And they've been conditioned and trained, even if that wasn't why they thought they joined, mm-hmm. right? They've been conditioned and trained to be in a mentality of us versus them and to do violence. So when I came home, I still had a reserve contract that I had to fulfill. As a result of my scholarship, you know, you are under the full span of the contract is 12 years because you go to college and then you have 8 years of service after that. So I signed a contract when I was 17 and then 18 that I wouldn't be out of until I was 30, which I think in and of itself is now, kind of crazy.
Right? Yeah.
Right. Like, yeah. I think that's a thing that people don't realize, mm-hmm. like how, you know, we're having 18-year-olds sign contracts that are going to last for so long.
And then in theory, right, it can just be extended, right? Yeah. Like, it's not a contract in the traditional sense.
Right.
Right?
Right.
I mean, it's...
Yeah.
If they want you for 15, they'll probably get you for 15.
Right. And plenty of mm-hmm. people here have that story, right, of being stop-lost, and mm-hmm. especially at the height of the, like, invasion and then the troop surges in 2012 even, and... So I was just trying to get my life together for a long time. You know, I came back and I think that I didn't have the language of moral injury at the time, but in hindsight, having learned that language, it makes a lot of sense, you know, that I was really confused about why I struggled so much, because I was like, I'm healthy, I can move on with my life now, mm-hmm. you know, and yet I really just struggled to function and get on my feet. And I think it was because I came home with this, like, very, like, unconscious but very visceral and, like, clear sense that what I had participated in wasn't something that was right or just. But I distracted myself by doing economic justice work and other kinds of work that felt productive, right? I felt like I was contributing to something positive. When Colin Kaepernick, when there was all the backlash happening about Colin Kaepernick taking a knee, and I was, you know, seeing there was this narrative popping up already, even at the very beginning, right, about, like, oh, disrespecting the flag and veterans, and I still had this sense of, like, we can be patriotic in a way that aligns with our values, mm-hmm. right? And so I was like, I wrote this whole long Facebook post. It kind of feels silly, right? Like, mm-hmm. this all started with me the thing that woke me up was me writing this Facebook post about how I supported Colin Kaepernick and how I thought that it was the most patriotic thing you could do and blah, 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 right? And I wrote it all out. I had bullet points, you know, making these arguments.
Yeah.
And then I had all these people replying, like, thank you for taking the time to write this out. I hadn't thought about a lot of this. Mm-hmm. It makes so much sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I still just can't support it because the veterans, right? Like the,
but you're
the,
saying
like,
I'm actively,
but
I'm
people were saying it to me. And, you know, it was just that like cognitive dissonance really struck me of like, but you're saying this to a veteran who is saying that, and that's your only reason. That's not an argument, you know? And it was then that I had been ranting about how the wars had become so quiet. We needed to talk more about them. They were still happening. Mm-hmm. It was horrible that they were still happening to my friends, to my family. But I hadn't, it had never occurred to me that, like, I could be a person using my voice to help people talk about it more, you know, and have a better analysis of, like, the truth of it and how, you know. And it was in that moment that I realized it. And so my next thought was, like, I'm going to start an organization that organizes veterans to speak out against nationalism, right? Mm-hmm. And against these, like, kind of warped ideas about what patriotism is that get used against social justice struggle. And then my friend, thankfully, was like, have you checked to see if any of those exist yet? So then I went looking. I got exposed to this whole world of, you know, Veterans for Peace and About Face. And then I got very quickly schooled on this history of GI resistance, which I had never heard of until then, ever. And, you know, then my wheels were turning because it suddenly, I realized, I'm like, I'm here in the reserve still just going through the motions, just trying to get, wait out my contract, but I could be doing something. You know, it's not okay for me to just, like, let myself off the hook. I'm still complicit in this system. I'm still a leader in this system, right? I'm a commissioned officer. And I don't believe that the soldiers that I'm leading and training are being sent to do something that is right. I don't believe that they're being sent to do the things that they're told that they're doing, you know, and so how could I? That was when it became really clear to me. Like, I actually, in order to uphold my oath as an officer and the Army values, as we're taught, right, integrity, courage, all of those things that I had to start saying something. I had to speak out. And so I gave a speech at the Poor People's Campaign at the end of the 40 Days of Action, which I was involved with the Poor People's Campaign, in front of tens of thousands of people. That was the first time I got threatened with investigation. So my commander called me and was like, soldiers are complaining about your speech and your social media activity. And I was like, well, they're welcome. You know, is there something specific? And he was like, well, I think some of the political stuff. And I was like, well, they're you know, welcome to be upset about that. He was like, okay. But then I had 2-week orders coming up, and I had given this big speech, right? And for me, even more, it was not just, like, the conviction that had developed in my own, like, heart, right, and body, but it was, like, I had put a stake in the ground publicly, very publicly, and I was, like, how can I still call myself a person of integrity if I then just, like, kind of go through these orders and train soldiers to participate in this, like, really immoral thing that I know that they're being lied to about, too. So I was kind of... It almost feels embarrassing sometimes because it gets called this, like, GI resistance thing, right? But to me, I didn't expect it to become a big thing the way it was. I was just like, how can I continue to maintain some level integrity by continuing to speak out even when I'm on these orders? Which is why I made these graphics with facts, you know, publicly available facts about the DOD. And then, you know, scheduled them to share one after the other. And I was super surprised to find myself doxxed by some Army WTF moments Twitter handle or something. They tagged all of my chain of command, and I think that that's when the Army Times picked it up. And so I was really shocked that that blew up the way that it did. The next day, I found out by reading that Army Times article that I was formally under investigation. I hadn't even been told yet. Yeah,
because you were out on your orders, and Twitter was posting them for you.
Right.
A scheduled post.
Yeah, yeah.
So you weren't watching it. You probably weren't, like, on Twitter that whole time.
Yeah, I mean, I was checking, but I wasn't, you know, I was running around doing, kind of being a lot of, being lost in my self-loathing mostly.
Sure.
But also trying to, I've been really mindful that I never wanted someone to say, I never wanted anyone to be able to undermine my message by saying that I wasn't a good officer. Mm-hmm. And that's the first thing people do, especially to women leaders, right? And so I was like, I'm going to do the best damn job I can in this training environment because I don't want people to be able to use that against me and say, oh, this message is bullshit because...
Yeah. Well, and you also didn't break any of your own... rules in the code. I know there's specific language around using some, there's a specific word, some kind of language about the commander-in-chief, and you avoided doing that.
Right.
You just shared statistics and facts about the U.S. military.
Yep, that's right. And that's why sometimes I feel like I get more credit than I feel comfortable with around this GI resistance concept, because technically what I did wasn't actually breaking the rules of the system, you know. The fact that the Army and the media decided to react to it the way that they did is what made it resistance.
Sure.
You know, it turned it into something that it didn't have to be, which was really, I don't know, from a strategic reflection perspective, a fascinating thing to experience.
Yeah.
And to be made so powerful all of a sudden, you know, by the people
like
who don't want you to be powerful.
You.
Right.
Yeah.
So then the Business Insider article came out, and, you know, then that's the long and short version of the story.
Great. Yeah. So I guess now, tomorrow, you will be decommissioned. Is that the right?
Not completely,
but you're on this threshold. So I guess what's your thought on how you're going to take this work forward with the freedom, I guess, that you'll have being now outside, a little more outside of the system?
Yeah.
What's your vision for what's next?
Yeah, I mean, I think that for me, so without getting into all of the, like, bureaucratic tangles I've been stuck in trying to get out, my service obligation finally ended this past May. I already had submitted a packet to go inactive because my chain of command had strangely tried to pressure me into doing that and said that they would expedite it, even though I was like, you know, you don't have to pressure me, I'm more than happy to do this.
Yeah.
It's, you know, a great opportunity that they, I only had because of their discretion. So I had submitted this packet to go into the IRR, and for anyone who doesn't know, the active reserves means that you're drilling, so you're going to training for weekends, sometimes long weekends every month, and then you're doing usually at least 2 weeks, often more, training during the summer every year, so you're on federal orders for that. And then you can get activated, right, to deploy or whatever. When you're inactive, or what people refer to as the IRR, that means that you're technically still able to be called back at any time by the military, but you don't have any requirements to report or do anything. And it's even dubious whether you're still subject to use to the UCMJ, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, at that point. So when my obligation date came around, I was ready to resign, but then I already had this packet circulating, so I've been waiting on that packet to finalize, and they kept saying that it was going to. Then they kept saying it got rejected. It was just bureaucratic nonsense, you know.
Sure.
And then my commander came back and said, well, it's looking like it's going to be 9 to 15 months for this to get processed now. When originally they'd said, we'll expedite it and it'll be done no more than 30 days or 90 days, right? And I was like, no, I'm not sitting around waiting for another year for y'all to sign this paperwork and submit it. That's all that had to happen.
Yeah.
So I told them I would be publicly resigning in a press conference the following Monday. This was a Monday, so 1 week out. By Wednesday, my IRR orders were cut. my commander got back to me and was like, so, strangely, your orders are getting cut today. So that's the situation I'm in now. Today is the day that those orders go effective, so I'll be in the IRR, and now I'm able to submit my resignation packet to get all the way, to resign my commission and get all the way out. And the way I see it looking from here is that, you know, I don't know, I've already kind of jumped into the work. I formally took a staff job with About Face Veterans Against the War 8 months ago as a drop the mic, standing for Military Industrial Complex campaign director, along with another amazing woman of color leader, Crystal Tubles. And, you know, I've been working on building awareness and particular and like movement capacity around holding a militarism analysis and doing anti-militarist work, which, you know, from my perspective includes decolonization work and, you know, is connected to environmental justice, gender mm-hmm. justice, economic justice, mm-hmm. racial justice, right?
Yeah.
And
policing domestically.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And I think that that's my perspective on it, is that it's about connecting the dots, right? It's not necessarily about building a whole new separate movement or anything like that. And I think too often anti-war folks think about it that mm-hmm. way, is instead it's about bringing an analysis of the system of mm-hmm. militarism and militarization yeah. and the way that it connects to yeah. the already like thriving movements that mm-hmm. we have in this moment, thanks to a very obvious common enemy,
yeah.
specifically in Trump, right? But systems that he yeah. is building on that have existed mm-hmm. for a long time.
Predate him, yeah.
So I think it looks like more of that. But I think the freedom part, it will be less about what I do tangibly in my work and more about being able to actually really start my own process of healing, because mm-hmm. it's been difficult to, like, hold, even though, you know, my alignment and my politics and all of that have become really crystal clear for me in the last months. I've only been speaking publicly about my feelings about the war, about militarism, for the last really year mm-hmm. and a half. So it's still, and I've been doing that while still this shadow is hanging over me, mm-hmm. you know, and I think to some extent it's hard to really heal from a thing when you're still kind of part of it.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm looking forward to the most.
Those moments of, like, what am I doing?
Yeah.
Talking about this so loudly. Yeah.
Right. Well, yeah. And it's just, I think it's, like, the very, like, subtle thing, like, holding these, like, very competing identities, mm-hmm. right? Even though it's, like, I've developed an alignment with sure. one, I still am, like, you know, hostage to this mm-hmm. other one, and that's a lot.
Yeah. So I guess it's a little bit clear, but, obviously, you know, you achieved what you originally wanted in some ways when you were 17, 18, of becoming a different kind of leader in this space.
I hadn't thought of it that way.
But you've had to come out of the structure. So I guess, what would you tell your 17-year-old self about this, like, changing the system from within
yeah.
idea that you had then, if you could talk to her now?
I would say to her that the limitation of that logic, right, that logic is correct all the way up until the point that you miss that you're a lone salmon swimming upstream mm-hmm. against a massive machine, right? And I think that was what I was missing at the time, was that I understood the problems as, like, individual policy change that needed to happen within the military, or individual leader, you know, better leaders, getting rid of toxic leaders and bad behavior. Mm-hmm. And I did not understand, I did not have a systems or structural analysis of how change happens and how change, or how problems, right, systems of oppression are rooted at a systems level. Mm-hmm. And so I think that if you're starting out, I wouldn't advise anyone. I will probably never, well, I know I'll never be the same. I will never get back the pieces of me that I lost by being a part of such a toxic system and being a part of such violence. And that's a thing I could not, no matter how much research I did, no matter how much I thought I was going into it with my eyes wide open, I could not have accounted for as an 18-year-old. Mm-hmm. The kind of, like, cost to my soul. And the way that would completely change the rest of my life and who I'm able to be for the rest of my life. So I would say that there are other ways to make systemic change, and you should look into those. And, like, I think that building movement that is deep and disciplined and based on unity of analysis and relationship building and power building is the approach I would recommend instead. Mm-hmm. But to people who are already in the military, I would say to think strategically about the impact that you can have where you're at. Mm-hmm. 'Cause I know from, you know, being in recently that, like, the morale is super low. A lot of people, most people don't support the wars, right? Even if they still, like I was, mm-hmm. have some sense that there might be some good that we're doing yeah. or that we're trying to do, they know that ultimately, like, we're not accomplishing anything good mm-hmm. in these wars that we've been yeah. in for 18 plus years yeah. now. Yeah. And I think most of us just haven't woken up to the idea that we have agency, that we have a choice, and that we're not alone, that we could be part of a long history of people doing really powerful things in place when they wake up and they realize they're part of this beast.
Mm-hmm.
Don't join to do that. But if you're already there, there's a role for you to play, I think.
Yeah. So does about face do mm-hmm. Do work in like truth and recruitment work with young people?
Yeah.
Because it's been wild to see. I remember recruiters being in my high school all the time, you know, 12, 13 years ago, mm-hmm. and they still are.
Yeah.
So what's the movement to address that look like
yeah.
around the country?
Well, and I think they're even ramping up because they're struggling to recruit, right? Like, there's even been some articles mm-hmm. about should we lower the recruitment age to 16 and things like, or the enlistment age, and I'm just like, please, no. As if we aren't already preying on young people who don't, mm-hmm. like, fully understand what they're getting themselves into.
Sure.
So we are set up in a chapter structure right now. I think we're going through kind of like a revamping of our movement and our energy as a network of mm-hmm. veterans and service members. And so we have a bunch of individuals who have a long history of doing truth and recruitment and continue to do that. There's one individual, Hart Vigas, who is just like, to me, a role model he's just super dedicated to going to schools constantly. And bring the truth. I had the opportunity to speak to a group of young folks from DRUM, which is an organization in New York that was doing a summer like organizing activism program about the you know what it actually means to join the military. So I think they happen in one-off opportunities at the local level like that. It's not one of our like primary national mm-hmm. strategies because from a national strategic perspective, I think we're still fleshing out what that is right now in mm-hmm. this moment, but I think that there's an acknowledgement that that's harm reduction, right?
Yeah.
That we can't, like, undo the military-industrial sure. complex that by, like out un-recruiting
yeah.
them.
The picking babies out of the river.
Right, analogy, exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think the way we kind of hold that is, like, it's a thing to do. It's a thing we can do really powerfully.
Mm-hmm.
That's a harm reduction component of our work that we do. And we're constantly trying to think about how do we build power? What would it take mm-hmm. for us to actually dismantle that system?
Yeah. Cool. Well, I don't know, what else do you want to share with folks? I want to respect your time. We're almost there. Is there anything that you wish I had asked that I didn't?
No. I mean, I guess the only thing that's on my mind in what we were just talking about is, like, what can be done,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I think that there's a lot. I think that militarism is a cultural thing that we have to address that has to do with how much we glorify and prioritize military knowledge. For example, like, why is military knowledge seen as, like, such an exceptional prerequisite for politics?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, why in one environment you're trained in particular to, like, do violence, right? And why is that seen as a qualification? And of mm-hmm. course, you learn a lot of other really valuable skills in the military.
Sure.
But I think challenging kind of our blind assumption that, like, all of those skills are skills that we want in leadership positions mm-hmm. in other environments, right? And I think that's true of police, right? Supposedly supposed to be peace officers, and yet we often have this intuitive sense that, like, oh, if you've been in the military, that's a natural transition into police, and yet no wonder we have all of these people coming back from war with this very us versus them,
mm-hmm.
do violence as the solution mentality,
yeah.
and that translates into our police departments and things like that. Not that that problem didn't exist before that, but
sure,
but it certainly, you know, it's something that we should be critical about and think about from a cultural perspective. But I want to plant the seeds for people to be thinking about what systemic change around dismantling this can look like in the shorter term, right? I think within 5 years. Right now, 507 out of 535 of our Congress members are receiving significant contributions from defense contractors. And that's legal. So think about that. Mm-hmm. You have corporations who almost their entire revenue comes from tax dollars, from government military contracts, mm-hmm. who then pour those dollars back into politicians to make sure that they continue getting those mm-hmm. contracts. It's literally bribery, mm-hmm. right? And we would call it corruption in any other context, but it's legal here. Mm-hmm. And so the first thing, a really simple structural change that would start to make a dent in this would be to pass legislation making it illegal for anyone either competing for federal contracts or receiving federal contracts to contribute to campaign finance donation, you know, mm-hmm. contributions. Simple.
Seems fair.
Simple. Yeah. Yeah. And like that affects every movement that we're seeing right now, because we know that anytime a movement gains, you know, from history, anytime a movement really gains power and starts to threaten the power structure, who gets called out? The National Guard, mm-hmm. right? And now super militarized other agencies like ICE, you know, police, mm-hmm. all of these other agencies, private contractors that are hired by corporations, like we're at, like at Standing Rock. And so, you know, I think breaking the link between that financial link from our politicians, I mean, that's almost mm-hmm. all of Congress, right? That's not a Democrat or Republican no. problem. That's almost all of our Congress. Mm-hmm. And those are just the explicit defense companies, too. That's not companies like Amazon mm-hmm. who have and are vying for massive defense contracts mm-hmm. but aren't in the defense contractor category.
Developing facial recognition and other right. stuff for...
Right, and yeah. spilling over now to be used for ICE mm-hmm. and, you know, all of these other really... frankly, fascist
yeah.
uses. So, you know, that's one thing I want to plant the seeds for, because that's not just an anti-war priority, mm-hmm. right? That will have spillover impacts mm-hmm. on the oil lobby, on the gun lobby, mm-hmm. right? On all of these corporations.
And on the flip side, every, you know, healthcare, accessible yeah. healthcare, people say, we don't have money. And yeah. that's, I think people just
of
need
course.
To... Every time someone says we don't have money, just point, like you did, to billions and trillions right. that are unquestionably poured into defense.
Right,
air
which
quotes.
Are actually
you can't hear
corporations.
My air quotes. I always do air quotes on that.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing I think people miss is people are like, oh, yeah, we have a huge defense budget, and maybe it's a little out of control, but, like, also I support the troops, so that's, you know, it's somewhat okay. But I don't think people realize that, like, I think it's either slightly more or slightly less than half of that budget is going to corporations, point blank. And that's not even the money that, like, filters through the military and then filters mm-hmm. to corporations, right? That's explicitly the budget. And, I mean, it's literally just, like, billions and billions and billions every year that are just going straight to corporations' bottom line. Mm-hmm. And then these CEOs and executives in particular making, like, 500 times what even the most high-ranking generals make, right? So I'm not here trying to make a case for, like, I don't know. I'm just saying that there's a lot of even ifs that mm-hmm. I think speak to how deceptive the narratives are about why the system is the way mm-hmm. that it is, right? And, like, the most important thing I want people to walk away with on that is that it's, like, it's happening because corporations are paying politicians to make sure that they keep getting those dollars. It's not going to troops, not really. Right, they're essentially cannon fodder in this, like, profit game, mm-hmm. And that's what I think is crazy, is even from a conservative perspective, right? Like, that we've allowed support the troops to somehow mean let them be used by corrupt politicians and corporations, and be lied to about what they're actually fighting for. You know, mm-hmm. like. Every time, I think it's important for us to talk about the other costs, right? The cost to Afghan people, the cost to Iraqi people, because we in the United States often only talk about, you know, the deaths of soldiers. But even if that's where you're coming from, right? If that's where you're at, that's what you care about, mm-hmm. then why aren't we asking the question of why, right? Like, okay, every week another two soldiers or whatever mm-hmm. getting in the headlines for dying in Afghanistan. Why? Mm-hmm. For what?
Yeah. Well, you know? The suicides... that
right.
it long outpaced the combat
exactly.
deaths,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So that, and then I think, like, the other things we should be doing are really challenging what, like, one, there's this posse comitatus like constitutional law, right? That's supposed to protect our democracy by preventing a military coup. It's the purpose of it, right? Mm-hmm. So that the rule that the military can never be used against the American people, except for in like super specific circumstances, to prevent the ability for politicians to use the military to, you know, overthrow mm-hmm. the democracy or whatever. And yet now we're seeing troops being used at migrant detention facilities, mm-hmm. concentration camps, essentially, right? We're seeing them being used at the border in ways that they're saying, oh, well, it's okay because it's still just logistics, but, like, who's the watchdog making sure that that's mm-hmm. actually what's happening? And now we see people actually playing a law enforcement function at these camps. We see, you know, federal agencies that are essentially militaries, mm-hmm. right? They're trained like the military. They're equipped like the military, sometimes more aggressively than the mm-hmm. military. And yet that doesn't for some reason fall under what I think are now outdated definitions of what posse comitatus applies mm-hmm. to. Mm-hmm. So another change that needs to happen is, like, all militarized forces, right? Like mm-hmm. a definition around not just the technical military, but militarized restrictions around the use of militarized mm-hmm. force on what we call U.S. soil, mm-hmm. right?
Well, and just locally, I mean, we have a direct pipeline from our base to our police and sheriff's departments.
Yep.
I mean, they're given an MRAP
yep.
as a gift.
Yeah.
Like, I don't understand how that doesn't fall under yeah. that, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And why do they need that?
They don't.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good, yeah, they that's don't. The answer. Yeah. Yeah. No, that's,
yeah.
We could talk about that for days.
I know.
And I want to respect your time. But
no, thank you.
But
thank
if
you
folks, so if folks are interested, whether they're veterans or not, yeah. Where would you point them for more resources and more information?
Sure. Well, obviously, I'm here as part of Veterans for Peace. You can Google Veterans for Peace and it will come up easily. If you are a post 9/11 person or interested in doing work with About Face, which is where I work, our website is aboutfaceveterans.org. And if you're not a veteran, there you'll see the Drop the Mic campaign. If you scroll down, just like the first thing you'll see is sign up for the Drop the Mic campaign. And anyone who wants to be part of building momentum around raising awareness about a systemic understanding of the military-industrial complex and building momentum towards doing something about it is welcome to join and sign up for that campaign.
Awesome. Yeah. Cool. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank
and
you.
The work you do.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah.